The Community Angels at National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation have been supporters of KXRW Community Radio since the beginning. They have a dream, a world without violence. NW CAVE helps to inform and educate the prevention of violence against women and children. Learn more about how you can help at nwcave.org.
Big thank you to Georgie's Garage and Grill for supporting KXRW programming. They offer a full bar and signature meals for breakfast, lunch, and dinner that is not the usual bar food. Their food will keep you coming back for more. Dine in or take out. They also offer a venue space for live music and community events. Georgie's Garage and Grill is located downtown Vancouver at 606 Broadway Street. More information can be found at georgiesgarageandgrill.com.
This is Hassling the Paranormal. I'm your host, Jason Hassler. I'm the director of Big River Paranormal, the Oregon team for the Atlantic Paranormal Society. I've been obsessed with the paranormal since having unexplained experiences as a child. These experiences left me with more questions than answers. Join me as we explore all things paranormal with some of the top specialists and experts in the paranormal community. Welcome to Hassling the Paranormal. I'm your host, Jason Hassler. Today's guest is James Clarkson, the UFO detective. How are you doing today, James?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about your background and how that led you becoming interested in UFO research.
Well, the simplest way to explain it is that I've had two parallel paths for most of my life. One was to become a serious investigator, and I managed to achieve that. I'm a veteran in the military police. I was a plainclothes military policeman at Fort Lewis, Washington. That's how I came to Washington State. I've served as a Aberdeen police officer for 20 years. I came out as a sergeant. I was in charge of fatal accident team. I've been a detective sergeant. I've also been in charge of training officers. After that, I spent 2 years as a child abuse detective and followed by a 10-year career as an investigator of fraud for the Washington State Department of Licensing in Olympia. And adding all that together, I reached retirement age. But obviously, that's just what I do to pay the bills. Where my heart has always been, ever since I was little, is the subject of unidentified flying objects. And more importantly, answering once and for all that fundamental question, are we alone?
So you've always just had that interest since as a child. Is there something you saw like on TV or radio or something that got you interested in that?
There actually was a radio broadcast is what really kind of brought it all together. I mean, I grew up as a little kid. I just naturally liked science fiction or anything like that. I was a precocious reader and read everything I could lay my hands on. I think I read my first novel when I was in second grade, and then it just went from there. But there was one time when I heard a radio broadcast, I believe it was on KGO Radio in San Francisco, which is where I grew up, and a man named John G. Fuller, this I believe was in 1966, he had just come out with a brand new book at the time called Incident at Exeter. And I was totally fascinated because this is about a whole series of rather spectacular UFO sightings in and around the area of Exeter, New Hampshire. And some of the main incidents involved on-duty police officers. And we're talking about, in this case, a classic flying disc with scintillating red lights going around the rim. It chased a couple of motorists down the highway towards Exeter. It was even seen by at least two of the officers when they took one of the witnesses back out to this place where he had seen it. And then, of course, it had all the classic elements because the Air Force came out and said, oh, no, you actually saw a stratotanker refueling overhead. So I started thinking, this is really fascinating, because by then I had an idea that someday I would go into law enforcement. So I was interested in, well, what do you got to do to become one? And they test you physically. They do check your eyesight. They check your hearing, your state of health, your mental stability, your physical fitness. And you have to pass a series of intelligence tests. Almost all law enforcement agencies test for those things. So we've got a policeman out there who's a veteran, at least one of them, probably more by the time this is over. And his eyesight is so bad that he can't tell the difference between an Air Force plane flying overhead at 20,000 feet and an object that is coming down to the ground so low that he grabs the witness who's standing next to him, pushes him down on the ground. He himself drops to one knee and starts to draw his pistol as his backup partner arrives on the scene, jumps out of the car, takes it all in, and screams, "Don't do it." So fortunately, he did not fire a shot at the alien craft. But I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture? Because this can't be all right.
So you're the former state director of MUFON in Washington State. What is MUFON and how did you get involved with that?
Well, that's because of the military police indirectly. When I was a plainclothes MP, I worked 24-hour duty days, and I didn't get a whole lot of sleep because we would have to do follow-up investigations on anything that the uniformed MPs found while they were on duty. And a big military base is like a city anywhere else. You do have all the same kinds of crimes. Now, if it was really serious, we'd kick it up to CID, and if they didn't get a quick arrest out of it, they'd figure out some way to kick it back down to us. So we were very busy people. But one night I'm up with the desk sergeant, and you got a picture. This is in the MP station. There's a big desk up front. This is like the center of military police operations. And this sergeant is sitting behind the desk, and he's got four or five phones on his desk, including a red phone to connect to headquarters. And he's got a big piece of plexiglass, and there are all these business cards. And I'm up there shooting the breeze with the desk sergeant, and I look down, and I see a business card. And it says, UFO Reporting Center, 206-722-3000. I looked at, I said, "Sarge, what is that?" And he looks up at me, and very matter of fact, he says, "That's where we report UFOs." And I went, "Oh, really?" And we proceeded to have a discussion about things that he had heard about and seen when he was over in Europe, like big UFOs coming down over military runways and hovering and all kinds of strange stuff. But I filed that away in the back of my mind. And it wasn't until 1987, early in the year, a big news story broke. And that was the year that this JAL pilot, I believe his name was Kenji Taroshi, flying a 747 into Anchorage, Alaska, and he sees an enormous UFO with several other UFOs hovering around it. He calls it in. The whole crew sees it. The FAA did one of those. First, they had it on radar, then they didn't, then they did, then they didn't. Then the CIA showed up, and they really didn't. So that just broke on the news, and I was fascinated. And I remembered that phone number. I called the phone number, 206-722-3000, and a man named Robert Gribble answered. He was the founder of the UFO Reporting Center, and he had been he'd been a firefighter in Seattle, but he loved UFOs, and so he started this hotline. It then was eventually in the early 90s was passed to Peter Davenport, who's been a lifelong friend of mine, and people may have heard of him because he's been on Coast to Coast and many other places throughout the years. Robert Gribble, he came on the phone. He said, "What are you reporting?" I said, "I'm not reporting anything. I want to know how I can help." And he said, "Have you ever heard of MUFON?" Well, I had never heard of it. Well, next thing I know, I'm joining the group. Whenever I could, which was not terribly often, I would get up to the meetings, which were in Seattle. And I met Peter Davenport and Larry and Marilyn Childs, who were the state directors. And eventually, through the years, I was in MUFON for 30 years. And the last 10 of that 30, Larry and Marilyn had gotten older. And they wanted to get out of it. And they passed the torch to me. So that's how I became state director.
Okay. So what is state director? What was your what was your responsibilities?
My responsibility was it was a whole bunch of things, but the primary responsibility was to supervise and make sure that all of the reported UFO reports to MUFON that had occurred in Washington State were somehow handled.
Okay.
And that turned out to be an awful lot of work.
I imagine so. How do you go about, when you take a report, how do you go about investigating that report?
Well, the first thing you do is you try and assess what you've got. In other words, you break the report down. What kind of a report is it? And it really goes back to the classification system that was originally set up by Dr. J. Allen Hynek. You know, you have your encounters. Was the object, whatever it was that is being reported, was it observed at 500 feet or less? If it's anything involving an encounter or a sighting at 500 feet or less, it's considered to be a close encounter.
Okay.
You start classifying it, you know, did they just see something? Did they see something? And did it interact with the environment? And even wilder is when they give you not only that, but they tell you that they saw the driver or the passengers.
Yeah.
Now you're getting in really interesting territory.
How often were you able to find logical explanations for what people have reported?
About 80% of the time.
Yeah, that would be my guess too. Yeah, pretty often.
And actually, the interesting thing about that is, I actually did a statistical breakdown. By the time I decided to report on what exactly I had accomplished. And it came out that out of every 10 UFOs, there were two that I would call UFO gold. And so, in other words, there's your 20%. It turned out that the Air Force basically came out, they didn't readily admit it, but they had about 20% that they never could explain, or at least they didn't tell us what the explanation was.
Yeah, that's probably more likely. Yeah, they don't come out and tell us much these days. Well, they're starting to tell us more, but yeah. So you're an author. Can you tell me about the books you've written?
I've written two books. One of them was that in the process of becoming a police officer, I'd say for the first year or so, I didn't tell anybody that I worked with that I was interested in UFOs for one very simple reason. I was trying to become established, and I was a rookie policeman, and cops are terrible, merciless kidders. And they will defend other officers to the hilt, but amongst themselves, when there's nobody around, they are the worst gossips and practical jokers on the planet. And I, even still, eventually I kind of, as I became more confident, I let it be known that I took this subject seriously. So then I got tinfoil hats and you know, little aliens in my locker and all kinds of stuff. By then, I didn't care. If I was being kidded and hassled, that meant that they were accepting me as one of the guys. But, and it's a big but, after we got through the giggle factor, they started telling me something crashed in the woods by Westport. So that's one of my books, is about the Westport UFO crash that took place at the end of the Thanksgiving Day weekend in November of 1979 at 10:50 p.m. on a Sunday night. That's one story. The other story is, like many other policemen, they always say that the three things that all policemen have in common are a mustache, a motorcycle, and a divorce. Well, I don't own a motorcycle, but got the other two. And eventually, I met an extraordinary woman who was the children's librarian in Aberdeen. And thank God, she decided to marry me. And we've been happily married ever since. And that's Joanne, who's in the other room rooting for her favorite baseball team.
Is the game going now?
Oh, God, yes. This is the big day.
Is it the Mariners game she's watching?
That happens later on today, but there's all the playoffs, you know, to establish who's who.
Yeah.
The final pecking order. So the games are really good. They're very intense. She was a librarian at that point. And one of the things that librarians try to do is to create programs that will draw more people into the library. And anything that will draw in adult males and teenagers is a big plus. Well, after she got to know me for a while, she said, how about you do a program in the library related to UFO? I'd never thought about it before, but I thought, why not? So I started doing it, and it kind of took off. And a lot of libraries wanted me to come and talk about UFOs because I would get a lot of people in there. I mean, like, there's been several times I can remember in Belfair and a few other places, if the fire marshal had ever showed up, we would have been in serious trouble. And there were a lot of people there. This is a hot subject. People want to talk about it. One time in 1993, I did a UFO talk in the Ocean Shores Library. And when I was all done, a very stern elderly lady came up to me, looked me right in the eye, and she said, the Air Force knows all about UFOs and they're keeping it a secret. And I said, well, how do you know? And she says, I work there. And I could tell she was dead serious. I gave her my business card. I said, you know, will you talk to me? And she said, I can't. They'll come and arrest me. So I said, if you ever change your mind, call me. Well, then I found out that she was like the elderly lady that everybody is kind of intimidated by in the community. She'd led the charity drive to get the new library. But what nobody knew, or not very many people knew, was that when she was a young woman, she worked in top secret laboratories at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and she had all of her papers and the security clearance that would have given her access to very restricted information. And it took her 4 years before she would talk to me. And the only reason she finally decided was that, flash forward to 1997. Think about the time then. The X-Files are going full bore on television. Let's face it, aliens were hot when the X-Files was on. 1997 was the 50th anniversary of Roswell, and I did not get to go, but I found out later they had to hire off-duty police officers from all over the state to do traffic control in Roswell because the UFO people were there in force because they were interested in celebrating. So this was a big deal. And the Air Force conveniently responded by publishing a book, Roswell Case Closed. And of course, because it's the Air Force, when they put out a book like that, it makes all the national news. It was on CNN, everything else. I get a phone call out of the blue. This very gruff voice talks to me and I knew instantly who it was. It just clicked. She goes, "It's a damn lie." And I said, "Well, how are you, June?" And we started talking. And she's telling me all this details. And I said, "How come you're willing to talk to me now and you weren't willing to talk to me 4 years ago?" And she says, "I've outlived two husbands. My cancer's in remission. What are they going to do? Shoot me or put me in prison? I can do either one." Well, I wasn't born yesterday. I said, "How soon can I be at your house?" And we started having meetings. And it was like it was destined to be in a way. We became friends. And not going to go into all the details, but Joanne and I, it took me a long time to get my head on straight. So we would get together and break up, get together and break up. And when I really got to know June, she was coming to the end of her life. And it was during a period when Joanne and I were not together. So I had extra time and we became friends, and she decided that she would trust me with her life story. So that's my other book. It's called Tell My Story, June Crane, the Air Force and UFOs, because the last time I talked to her when she was on hospice, I said, "What do you want me to do, June?" And she said, "Tell my story." So I have kept that promise all these years. And I even got to tell her story in Paris in 2010. And my book has been translated into French.
So very cool.
I've taking her story to other people has opened doors for me that I never thought would be open.
Where do people purchase your books at?
Amazon. You can go to my website, which is ufodetective.com, and I can, we can set it up where I can mail out copies.
Okay.
And also, people can come to I try to attend conferences, and because there's been like a huge period of enlightenment, and I wanted to make sure that I mentioned this during our interview today, I have found that the paranormal community is much more open to the entire UFO subject now than I think they ever were before.
Yeah, definitely. As a member of the paranormal community, I can attest to that. We're pretty much trying to open up to everything as far as like UFOs, aliens, Bigfoot, all that kind of stuff, and putting our conferences like together, really. So that brings me to another topic. You're going to be a speaker at the Port Gamble conference coming in November 7th, correct?
Absolutely. That is a terrific conference. I love Port Gamble.
Yeah, it's my favorite of the year. What topic are you going to be presenting this year?
Well, we have a very unusual program. We're going to be going in a different direction. My wife, Joanne, she's multi-talented. She's a published poet, but she's also a psychic medium, and she has read palms since she was a little girl, and also the tarot. So she and I are going to do, this is a way of telling a story. We are going to stage a little play, and it's titled Women of Ufology, The Detective and the Psychic Tell Their Stories. So guess which part I get? And she will be the psychic, and she is going to channel some key witnesses from ufology. And that way we'll tell their stories.
And what date are you going to be presenting on? Do you know yet? I know it's November 6th.
I don't have a schedule in front of me, but I think it's on the Saturday, but I'm not sure off the top of my head. I'd have to look it up. I know he has the whole schedule online now.
Yeah, I was just looking at that earlier, but I forgot to look at the date for yours. I'll be teaching in class there. Coming into the paranormal community, doing, presentations and stuff there, have you had a chance to go on any of the investigations in Port Gamble, or maybe have your own ghost experience?
Huh. Oh, there's a great story. I had something. I didn't get to go this last year because of a health problem. But the year before that, this is wild. On the Saturday morning, I made a point. I wanted to hear this historical presentation that was going on over in the pavilion. And Joanne was upstairs, you know, with the table, meeting people there. So when this lecture was all over, I went back over to the main building at Port Gamble, and the bathrooms are on the first floor. So I thought, well, I'll swing by the men's room and go upstairs. So little did I know, I was about to have my first ghost experience. I go down the hall there, and the bathroom is very small. There's a sink and with a mirror above it. There's a urinal, a kind of half partition, a toilet, and then there's a window up in the wall that's letting sunlight in. Well, when I walked down there, there was nobody else in that end of the building at all. And I could see all the way through the room. And I could see there's nobody in there. So I thought, hey, this is cool. I jet in there and I'm taking care of business at the urinal. I'm facing the wall and I can plainly see my shadow outline on the wall. This is very important because the sun is coming through the window up high and to my right, and it's creating my shadow against the wall. All at once, with no warning. One of the things, you know this, is we all of us males know, you don't crowd somebody at the, at the urinal. All at once, a shadow of a larger, taller man comes up and superimposes over my shadow. I'm thinking that somebody is like, big guy is now crowding me. I turn and look over my right shoulder. There's nobody there. I look over my left shoulder and there's nobody there. I'm thinking that we need to move along and get out of here. And I rush over to the sink. And here's part two of this weird experience. When I turn, I still don't see anybody. Nobody has walked into the room. I'm still the only person, as far as I know, at that end of the building on the first floor. I'm at the sink. I'm washing my hands, and I heard a voice that I'm not prone to hearing voices out of the blue. This never happened to me before. I hear a voice that says, brother, you are welcome here.
Interesting. And
my response to that is, because I'm about done washing my hands at that point, is, thank you.
Like anybody else, yeah.
I'm out of there, and I ran upstairs, and I told Joanne. She grabbed Pete Orbe. I told it to him. And you know what Pete's response was?
What's that?
He says, why is it always the men's room? It had happened before.
Yeah, I have heard stories of that men's room, and I think about that every time I'm in there. But thankfully, nobody has bothered me while I was peeing at Port Gamble. But if you're going to have an experience in Port Gamble, I guess it's going to be in the men's room at the theater.
Well, it could be. It could also be. I mean, if Joanne was in here, she could tell you all the strange things that have gone on when we were over in the attic of the Walker Ames house.
That is one of my favorite places.
Parts of that too. There's something very strange about Port Gamble.
For sure. Yeah, and that conference is November 7th through the 9th, coming up real soon. So hopefully people can come see us there. I'm teaching a class on paranormal ethics there, and you'll be doing your presentation. There's all sorts of investigations and things there. It's a great place to be, for sure. The whole town is haunted and has creepy stories and all sorts of stuff. So it's a good time there. So my show airs in Vancouver, Washington, and I myself have had UFO sightings here locally. What stories have you heard? Any UFO stories here in the Vancouver, Washington area?
Well, this is really interesting because I had one of the best cases that I have ever investigated, period, because of a sighting by an on-duty federal agent in downtown Vancouver, Washington at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on July 2nd of 2014.
Okay.
I got a phone call out of the blue. I bear in mind this is back when I am still state director, and this man, who is obviously very serious, is on the phone. This case did not come in through MUFON. This was somebody looking me up and deciding to call. He's very cagey. He wants to report, but he doesn't want to report. It finally comes down to it. He's a federal agent. He was on duty. They were on a stakeout. They were waiting to arrest somebody who never showed up. As he's looking out at the sky, through the window of the car that he's in with the window rolled down. He looks towards the river and he hears this. These are his exact words. I saw movement in the sky 45 degrees above the horizon to the southeast. I observed a metallic disc, silver in color, circular in shape, moving rapidly across the sky from south to the northeast. The movement was from my right to my left. He also goes on to describe how the object glinted as it tilted slightly. It appeared to be several thousand feet up, and it looked to him, if you held a dime at arm's length, the dime would have just covered the object. It had no sound. There was no contrail. And he went through the mental checklist. No wings, no tail, no windows, no lights, landing gear, or anything that were components of a conventional airframe, either rotor or fixed wing. He also pointed out that it was not like any unmanned aerial vehicles. He had spent time prior to being employed in a particular agency, he had spent time doing security work on a flight line. He was very familiar with aircraft. And I want to point out that this witness, I ended up meeting him in person twice. We talked on the phone multiple times. We exchanged a lot of email. And I ended up because he made this report just a couple days after it happened, I contacted the FAA. And I decided this was worth the money. I paid their fee. It was about $200. And I got their radar data for the date and time that the event occurred. I took the data and I gave it to Bill Puckett, who runs UFOs Northwest. He is a retired NOAA weatherman, and he was able to unpack the data and put it on a map. Well, as he's telling me this originally, when the agent gave me the account, and it's also in his written statement, he made a comment that the really weird part of this whole experience was what happened next. He said there was a change in it. There was a blurriness that was inconsistent with the sky behind it. He said it was as if craft crossed a line in the sky, and when it crossed the line, it was no longer visible. He said the time from complete visibility to disappearance was 2 to 3 seconds. Either the craft cloaked or it took a shortcut out of the area. So now here he is. He's just seen the strangest thing in the sky that he's ever seen. And here comes an F-15 on afterburners from the direction of the Portland International Airport. And they do have F-15s down there ready to go to respond to whatever. He, in the place in the sky where he saw this thing disappear, there were three solid returns of something that had no transponder. And we also got the radar track of the F-15 plainly going across the sky. So to just kind of encapsulate this sighting, I have an on-duty federal agent in the prime of his health who makes an observation of an extraordinary aircraft which does not have a conventional explanation. It performs in ways that I don't think most aircraft don't. That's a safe conclusion. We have apparently government interest in it. I mean, it doesn't, and we have partial radar confirmation. I don't think you could have too much better of a UFO case. The only thing that would make it better would be if I could bring you a photo or if I could bring you the whole thing on a trailer.
Right. With little green men.
So that's one of the best cases I've ever had. But when I dug into the records, within a couple days of that, there was another case where two people were sitting in a hot tub and they observed a circular glowing disc. They describe it as moving rapidly at low altitude. He believes it was no further than 300 feet overhead. When he saw it, he thought that a penny, if he held a penny at arm's length, it would just have covered it. That's a question that I always ask witnesses. If you imagine that you're seeing the object in the sky, What is the smallest object that would just cover it up? Because it's important to know, you know, get some rough idea of how far away it was or how big it is.
Yeah, for sure. So what happens with the information once you make the report? Do you just file it away and see if it's comparable to other things, or what do you do with it?
Yes, that's pretty much it. And then the problem, this gets into one of the big problems with MUFON. One of the things that's very frustrating is, what do you do with all this information? The other problem is, who is getting it? Because in some ways it could be argued that when you work for MUFON, you're actually providing a like a civilian ground observer corps for the Air Force, because obviously they could monitor whatever is reported. I mean, how hard would that be? They let anybody join.
Yeah. So plus the Air Force probably has way better technology to be monitoring that kind of stuff and knows way more than we do. And, you know, so having us have civilians actually see that kind of stuff probably doesn't help with them keeping it quiet. That's for sure.
That's one of the most important parts. And you know, I'm coming to the point where, obviously, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to solve the mystery, quote unquote, in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And yep. So what have I accomplished? Well, if nothing else, I'm helping to preserve the history. And the history of UFOs is very fascinating. If you take all the sightings by, they're basically ordinary people who would be believed. If they were on a jury, they would be believable.
Yeah. I just had Vince from the Flying Saucer Party in Chehalis on a couple months ago to tell the story about the Chehalis Flying Saucer Party and why they have that. And a lot of people don't realize that the term flying saucer came from right here in Washington State. Exactly. They argue, and of course, I think they just had this on Coast to Coast, where Vince and some people from Chehalis came on and had like a little debate with people from Roswell to debate, which was, the original UFO stuff. So, yeah, I think that's kind of a cool story. But a lot of people don't realize the history, you know, it's been so far. And that it did start, the flying saucer did start here in Chehalis. I can't remember the exact story, but I believe a pilot was coming from Chehalis and going to Yakima, and he saw a flying saucer.
June 24th, 1947, Kenneth Arnold, who was a businessman, he actually flew a small plane because he was a salesman. He would go fly from place to place selling fire suppression equipment. And he was flying deliberately over Mount Rainier by a particular route on his way east of the mountains, because a military transport plane had gone down on Mount Rainier. And you got to bear in mind, back then, they did not have the radar coverage that we have now. They were trying to figure out where this thing crashed. So he's up there looking for that. And that's when, in daylight, he sees a formation of very strange flying discs. In fact, they were not true discs. They were kind of a crescent-shaped craft. And he made detailed observations. And when he landed, it was when the press got a hold of it, it was like striking a match to a pool of gasoline. Suddenly, everybody was talking about UFO. And of course, that was when that news reporter from the East Oregonian interviewed Mr. Arnold, and he said, "How did they fly?" And Kenneth Arnold was kind of frustrated and said, "Well, you know, like you flew a saucer over the water." And when the newspaper reporter was taking notes, I don't think he realized at the time that he was giving us a phrase that would be in the English language forever.
Yeah, very interesting, for sure.
Yes.
So back then, you know, in that era, we were having a lot of what appeared to be crashes and that kind of stuff. People believed to be UFO crashes, and you don't hear about that so much anymore. Are aliens getting better at flying, or the government getting better at covering that up? Or what do you think is going on? We don't get a whole lot of UFO crash sightings anymore.
I think it's a matter of covering up is part of it. The other part, I don't know if this has been confirmed, but one of the theories was there were deliberate attempts to bring them down with focused radar beam. Now, I don't know how true this is, but that's one of the theories that's been kicked around. The problem is the entire UFO phenomena, it's very much like trying to study an iceberg. So most of what's really going on, you never get to see.
Yeah.
We get to see what's above the surface.
A lot of people are speculating these days that maybe some of the UFO sightings that we're seeing may not be from a different planet, but maybe from our oceans. What's your take on that?
I think that's highly probable.
Yeah.
There's a, you know, when you're in this subject long enough, what is old becomes new again. There is an author, you can look him up, Ivan T. Sanderson. Very interesting gentleman, excellent writer. He wrote a definitive book on Bigfoot, Sasquatch, you know, however you want to describe them. It's a massive reference book, quite thorough. He wrote a number of books on paranormal phenomena, but the beauty of them is they're written in such a way that they're approachable by anybody. He doesn't try to, you know, bury you in scientific jargon. And one of his earliest books was about undersea UFO. And
okay.
It's a classic. I'm trying to come up with it over here. Invisible Residence.
Okay.
That's one.
Yeah, I mean, most of our oceans are unexplored, so it would make sense.
Yes. And actually, there's a simple way to understand the problem. You can take any globe of the Earth, and when you turn it a certain way, you will see very little land. In other words, if you flew towards the Earth and you were coming in that direction, your first conclusion would be that the Earth was mostly covered in water.
Yeah.
You begin to realize just how enormous the oceans are. You could hide anything down there. I mean, there's some places. I mean, think of the possibilities. If you had what are known as transmedium vehicles.
Okay. What
you
is
could
that?
Go from one element to the other. You could come and go. You wouldn't need to fly to a different planet.
Yeah. So have you done any reports on, had any reports from people that believe that what they saw came from the ocean or coming from
very
the ocean?
Few, because the only times you get those reports would be if you're dealing with, you know, fishermen or somebody like that. But they just weren't, I don't doubt that those reports exist. I just never saw very many of them coming into MUFON.
Yeah. Are people reporting abductions like they used to back in the 80s and 90s when TV shows like Sightings and Unsolved Mysteries made that like a popular phenomenon?
No, they're not reporting them with the frequency. But of course, the ones that are reported are not making the news the way they did.
Yeah.
So see, again, it gets confusing.
Yeah. Do you think that's because people have kind of just like shunned it or just kind of more accepted it as something that just happens?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
There is a stigma. If you start telling people that you were abducted by aliens last night, you know, you are taking a risk.
Yeah, they might put you in lockdown for a little while.
Well, you have to demonstrate that you're potentially a harm to yourself or to others.
Yeah.
Just being full goose bozo is not enough to get you locked up.
Thankfully for most of us, right?
I'm not saying, you know, in making that remark, I am not saying that there are not valid alien abductions.
Yeah, for sure.
There are.
I can attest to that. I've told my story online a few times, but when I was a child, I did see a UFO outside my bedroom window. It was a triangular shape, and I watched it land, and for whatever reason, despite the fact that we lived on 40 acres, it landed on a building in the field. For whatever reason, I have no idea why it would land on the building because there was plenty of grass to land on, but it did. So I woke my parents up screaming that a UFO landed. They told me to go to sleep, and then I had a bad dream. And the next morning, that building was crushed. So,
yeah. Wow.
Uh-huh. So I have slight little memories of seeing what appeared to be like gray aliens in my house, and then being with them in a room with my brother, who's my twin. But I don't remember much other than just telling us like, you're fine, you're going to be okay. So that it's, you know, and that's kind of one of the reasons I have such an interest in the paranormal is because of that happening as a child. The house that we lived in was he was pretty haunted as well. So I had a few different paranormal experiences there. So that's where I got my interest from. Yeah.
I consider that a great blessing.
Yeah.
You fall into that category of witnesses that I have encountered many times over the years. One of the first things that I get asked whenever I start talking about UFOs is they want to know what my weird experience has been.
Yeah.
Well, until the year that I had the ghost encounter in the bathroom there, I really didn't have much to contribute to that conversation.
Yeah.
But so people would say, well, what UFOs have you seen? And I would end up saying, you know, always a bridesmaid, never a bride. I keep waiting. I'm envious of you, the experiences that you've had, because I don't get the sense that you have a very negative response to your experience.
No, I have a very, they made it very clear that they weren't out to harm us. I mean, as a child, I didn't know if I, you know, like in my mind as a child, like when my parents told me, hey, you had a bad dream or you're just imagining things. You know, I kind of believe that until, you know, of course, the proof was there in the field with the building being crushed. But yeah. So, yeah, it definitely shows me that I did actually have that experience. Yeah, I remember them leaving.
Have you ever tried to trace the history of that building?
You know, it was like a 100-year-old house, and it wasn't like I'd had several different, it belonged to a family member. We'd had several different family members live in that house throughout the years. In fact, it wasn't actually in its original location. I think it was on the same property, but moved to different places, but around the property. But the house no longer exists. The property's still there. They're actually, unfortunately, turning the property into a subdivision like everywhere else these days. But
yeah,
it was an old farmhouse, and it was really cool living there when we did, because it was an old farmhouse with, you know, ghosts and apparently aliens too. And, you know, and I don't know why I had that experience. That is my biggest question, is why. Why did I have that experience? And, you know, we lived that very close to what used to be Camp Bonneville, is, you know, the military camp. I believe that's a closed, I mean, it's still there, but I don't think it's active anymore. But they used to watch a lot of times. They would have exercises with like the helicopters and that kind of stuff. And that was always really cool. So at first, that's what I thought it was, until, of course, it was not a helicopter, you know. So I almost wonder if maybe the two were related, because it was the
paranormal and the UFO field.
Well, the UFO and the military base that was so close.
It's conceivable. The main thing, there are a few direct linkages. Like one of the things that I've discovered over and over again, and there are tons of literature to bear this out. Any place that you have something nuclear, you will have really good UFO reports.
Yeah.
They go together like, you know, coffee and cream, bread and butter, whatever. You have one, you have the other.
It does appear they're watching our nuclear sites. And in fact, there's been many reports that they have shut down our nuclear sites at certain times.
Yes.
Maybe they're just letting us know, you think you could blow up your planet, but you can't, because we'll stop you.
I know a gentleman who's a former Air Force captain who actually he served for years in those, you know, that duty in missile silos where you're one of the two guys with a key, and together, if you both turn your keys, you could destroy half the world. Well, it's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
And he was there when UFOs got shut down. UFOs shut down ICBMs, you know, and then there was a huge cover-up.
Yeah, that'd be a scary experience. I'm sure he can't really talk as much as he'd like to about it, but.
Well, he can now to a certain degree, and he did try and disclose to, this gets into the whole government secrecy thing, but he has a very low opinion of that organization called Arrow.
Okay.
Because they really don't want to, they pretend like they do, but they actually don't want testimony from people like him.
Yeah, interesting, for sure. Well, we are about out of time here. So if people want to know more about you, buy your books, where they can find that information, UFOdetective.com?
UFOdetective.com. My email is UFOdetective@hushmail.com, HUSMAIL. And I'm always glad even if you're not shopping for a book, if you have a UFO question or a comment or a sighting that you want to tell me about or whatever, I would like to hear about it.
Well, thank you for coming on. I will see you next month in Port Gamble, and hopefully we will have more privacy in the bathroom.
There you go. Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
You got it. Bye now.
Programming like this is made possible by support from High Five Cannabis, your local cannabis connection in Vancouver and Stevenson, Washington. High Five offers flower, concentrates, edibles, tinctures, topicals, and more. Whether you're new to cannabis or know what you need, their staff is available to assist. If you go to highfivecannabis.com, spelled H-I-G-H, the number 5, cannabis.com, you can learn about their specials like Munchie Monday, Senior Tuesdays, Waxy Wednesdays, and Loyalty Thursdays. Again, that's highfivecannabis.com.
Oh, you know it! You better work.
Discover our city's hidden gem, hiding right below the sidewalk. Underbar is a speakeasy-themed cocktail lounge located downtown Vancouver. As an LGBTQ-friendly and gay-owned space, it is a go-to destination for weekly events such as comedy, trivia, bingo, and open mic nights. Local artists are featured every first Friday of the month, and every fourth Sunday is Underbar's Underground Drag Brunch Show, 2 to 4 p.m. More information and location can be found at underbarvancouver.com. That's underbarvancouver.com. If you're looking for pizza in East Vancouver, consider visiting Giuliano's Pizzeria in the Cascade Park Fisher's Landing neighborhood. For 37 years, Giuliano's has been a choice for Clark County residents. Giuliano's has a casual classic rock atmosphere, open 7 days a week, and they provide table service allowing you to relax and enjoy your meal with family and friends. If you have a large crowd to feed, Giuliano's can deliver six or more extra large pizzas to your office or event. More information can be found at giulianospizza.com.
Thank you for listening to Hassling the Paranormal with Jason Hassler. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll tune in next month for an all-new episode of Hassling the Paranormal right here on KXRW 99.9 FM.
KXRW programming is made possible by partners like Buckley & Associates, attorneys at law, helping injured victims seek the justice they deserve for over 40 years, licensed in Washington State. Our diverse team speaks over 7 languages, making your rights more accessible and easier to understand. Learn more at BuckleyLaw.net. Again, that's BuckleyLaw.net. Buckley & Associates. We speak your language.
The community angels at National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation have been supporters of KXRW Community Radio since the beginning. They have a dream, a world without violence. NW CAVE helps to inform and educate the prevention of violence against women and children. Learn more about how you can help at nwcave.org.
The Columbian in Southwest Washington continues to offer the most comprehensive and consistent coverage of our region and our people, despite the challenges faced by local newspapers nationwide. Valued donations to our community-funded journalism project via the Local Media Foundation pays for local reporters to provide expanded and in-depth coverage of key local issues in print and online, including homelessness, transportation, and the environment. For the most thorough daily coverage, visit Columbian.com. Please consider donating or subscribing today.
The Columbian calls singer-songwriter Al Perez a soulful performer masterfully woven, whether he's on his acoustic guitar solo or backed by his 5-member live band. Al Perez has thrilled local and abroad audiences for over 2 decades with his unique blend of light rock, R&B, fan-favorite covers, and a touch of Latin flavor. To book Al Perez or hear his latest Warrior Records release, Love Revolution, go to warriorrecords.com/Al-Perez. That's warriorrecords.com/Al-Perez.
With your hand in my hand, your body kissed by the sun.
troubles fall.